Chapter 22. We entered the Eternal City at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the 30th of January by the Porta del Popolo, and came immediately. It was a dark, muddy day, and there had been heavy rain on the skirts of the carnival. We did not, then, know that we were only looking at the fag end of the masks, who were driving slowly round and round the piazza until they could find a promising opportunity for falling into the stream of carriages, and getting, in good time, into the thick of the festivity, and coming among them so abruptly, all travel-stained and weary, was not coming very well prepared to enjoy the scene. We had crossed the Tiber by the Pont Mall 2 or 3 miles before. It had looked as yellow as it ought to look, and hurrying on between its worn-away and miry banks, had a promising aspect of desolation and ruin. The masquerade dresses on the fringe of the carnival did great violence to this promise. There were no great ruins, no solemn tokens of antiquity, to be seen. They all lie on the other side of the city. There seemed to be long streets of commonplace shops and houses, such as are to be found in any European town. There were busy people, equipages, ordinary walkers to and fro, a multitude of chattering strangers. It was no more my Rome, the Rome of anybody's fancy, man or boy, degraded and fallen, and lying asleep in the sun among a heap of ruins, than the Place de la Concorde in Paris is. A cloudy sky, a dull cold rain, and muddy streets, I was prepared for, but not for this. And I confess to having gone to bed, that night, in a very indifferent humor, and with a very considerably quenched enthusiasm. Immediately on going out next day, we hurried off to St. Peter's. It looked immense in the distance, but distinctly and decidedly small, by comparison, on a near approach. The beauty of the piazza, on which it stands, with its clusters of exquisite columns, and its gushing fountains so fresh, so broad, and free, and beautiful, nothing can exaggerate. The first burst of the interior, in all its expansive majesty and glory, and, most of all, the looking up into the dome, is a sensation never to be forgotten. But, there were preparations for a festa. The pillars of stately marble were swathed in some impertinent frippery of red and yellow. The altar, and entrance to the subterranean chapel, which is before it, in the center of the church, were like a goldsmith's shop, or one of the opening scenes in a very lavish pantomime. And though I had as high a sense of the beauty of the building, I hope, as it is possible to entertain, I felt no very strong emotion. I have been infinitely more affected in many English cathedrals, when the organ has been playing, and in many English country churches, when the congregation have been singing. I had a much greater sense of mystery and wonder, in the Cathedral of San Mark at Venice. When we came out of the church again, we stood nearly an hour staring up into the dome, and would not have gone over the cathedral then, for any money. We said to the coachman, "Go to the Colosseum." Apostrophe in a quarter of an hour or so, he stopped at the gate, and we went in. It is no fiction, but plain, sober, honest truth, to say, so suggestive and distinct is it at this hour, that, for a moment actually in passing, and they who will, may have the whole great pile before them, as it used to be, with thousands of eager faces staring down into the arena, and such a whirl of strife, and blood, and dust going on there, as no language can describe. Its solitude, its awful beauty, and its utter desolation, strike upon the stranger the next moment, like a softened sorrow, and never in his life, perhaps, will he be so moved, and overcome by any sight, not immediately connected with his own affections and afflictions. To see it crumbling there, an inch a year, its walls and arches overgrown with green, its corridors open to the day, the long grass growing in its porches, young trees of yesterday, springing up on its ragged parapets, and bearing fruit. Chance produce of the seeds dropped there by the birds who build their nests within its chinks and crannies, to see its pit of fight filled up with earth, and the peaceful cross planted in the center, to climb into its upper halls, and look down on ruin, 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 all about it, the triumphal arches of Constantine, Septimus Severus, and Titus, the Roman Forum, the palace of the Caesars, the temples of the old religion, fallen down and gone, is to see the ghost of old Rome, wicked, wonderful old city, haunting the very ground on which its people trod. It is the most impressive, the most stately, the most solemn, grand, majestic, mournful sight, conceivable. Never, in its bloodiest prime, can the sight of the gigantic Colosseum, full and running over with the lustiest life, have moved one's heart, as it must move all who look upon it now, a ruin. God be thanked. A ruin. As it tops the other ruins. Standing there, a mountain among graves. So do its ancient influences outlive all other remnants of the old mythology and old butchery of Rome, in the nature of the fierce and cruel Roman people. The Italian face changes as the visitor approaches the city, its beauty becomes devilish, and there is scarcely one countenance in 100, among the common people in the streets, that would not be at home and happy in a renovated Colosseum tomorrow. Here was Rome indeed at last, and such a Rome as no one can imagine in its full and awful grandeur. We wandered out upon the Appian Way, and then went on, through miles of ruined tombs and broken walls, with here and there a desolate and uninhabited house. Past the Circus of Romulus, where the course of the chariots, the stations of the judges, competitors, and spectators, are yet as plainly to be seen as in old time. Past the tomb of Cecilia Metella, past all enclosure, hedge, or stake, wall or fence, away upon the open Campagna, where on that side of Rome, nothing is to be beheld but ruin. Except where the distant Apennines bound the view upon the left, the whole wide prospect is one field of ruin. Broken aqueducts, left in the most picturesque and beautiful clusters of arches, broken temples, broken tombs. A desert of decay, somber and desolate beyond all expression, and with a history in every stone that strews the ground. On Sunday, the Pope assisted in the performance of High Mass at St. Peter's. The effect of the cathedral on my mind, on that second visit, was exactly what it was at first, and what it remains after many visits. It is not religiously impressive or affecting. It is an immense edifice, with no one point for the mind to rest upon, and it tires itself with wandering round and round. The very purpose of the place is not expressed in anything you see there, unless you examine its details, and all examination of details is incompatible with the place itself. It might be a pantheon, or a senate house, or a great architectural trophy, having no other object than an architectural triumph. There is a black statue of St. Peter, to be sure, under a red canopy, which is larger than life, and which is constantly having its great toe kissed by good Catholics. You cannot help seeing that. It is so very prominent and popular. But it does not heighten the effect of the temple, as a work of art, and it is not expressive to me at least of its high purpose. A large space behind the altar was fitted up with boxes, shaped like those at the Italian Opera in England, but in their decoration much more gaudy. In the center of the kind of theater thus railed off, was a canopied dais with the Pope's chair upon it. The pavement was covered with a carpet of the brightest green, and what with this green, and the intolerable reds and crimsons, and gold borders of the hangings, the whole concern looked like a stupendous bonbon. On either side of the altar was a large box for lady strangers. These were filled with ladies in black dresses and black veils. The gentlemen of the Pope's guard, in red coats, leather breeches, and jack boots, guarded all this reserved space, with drawn swords, that were very flashy in every sense, and from the altar all down the nave, a broad lane was kept clear by the Pope's Swiss guard, who wear a quaint striped surcoat and striped tight legs and carry Albert's light clothes, which are usually shouldered by those theatrical supernumeraries who never can get off the stage fast enough and who may be generally observed to linger in the enemy's camp after the open country held by the opposite forces has been split up the middle by a convulsion of nature. I got upon the border of the green carpet, in company with a great many other gentlemen, attired in black, no other passport is necessary, and stood there at my ease, during the performance of mass. The singers were in a crib of wirework like a large meat safe, or bird cage, in one corner, and sang most atrociously. All about the green carpet, there was a slowly moving crowd of people, talking to each other, staring at the Pope through eyeglasses, defrauding one another, in moments of partial curiosity, out of precarious seats on the bases of pillars, and grinning hideously at the ladies. Dotted here and there were little knots of friars, Franciscani, or Cappuccini, in their coarse brown dresses and peaked hoods, making a strange contrast to the gaudy ecclesiastics of higher degree, and having their humility gratified to the utmost by being shouldered about and elbowed right and left on all sides. Some of these had muddy sandals and umbrellas and stained garments, having trudged in from the country. The faces of the greater part were as coarse and heavy as their dress. Their dogged, stupid, monotonous stare at all the glory and splendor, having something in it, half miserable and half ridiculous. Upon the green carpet itself, and gathered round the altar, was a perfect army of cardinals and priests, in red, gold, purple, violet, white, and fine linen. Stragglers from these went to and fro among the crowd, conversing two and two, or giving and receiving introductions, and exchanging salutations. Other functionaries in black gowns, and other functionaries in court dresses, were similarly engaged. In the midst of all these, and stealthy Jesuits creeping in and out, and the extreme restlessness of the youth of England, who were perpetually wandering about, some few steady persons in black cassocks, who had knelt down with their faces to the wall, and were poring over their missals, became, unintentionally, a sort of humane man-traps, and with their own devout legs, tripped up other people's by the dozen. There was a great pile of candles lying down on the floor near me, which a very old man in a rusty black gown with an open-work tippet, like a summer ornament for a fireplace in tissue paper, made himself very busy in dispensing to all the ecclesiastics. One apiece. They loitered about with these for some time, under their arms like walking sticks, or in their hands like truncheons. At a certain period of the ceremony, however, each carried his candle up to the Pope, laid it across his two knees to be blessed, took it back again, and filed off. This was done in a very attenuated procession, as you may suppose, and occupied a long time. Not because it takes long to bless a candle through and through, but because there were so many candles to be blessed. At last they were all blessed. And then they were all lighted, and then the Pope was taken up, chair and all, and carried round the church. I must say that I never saw anything, out of November, so like the popular English commemoration of the 5th of that month. A bundle of matches and a lantern would have made it perfect. Nor did the Pope, himself, at all mar the resemblance, though he has a pleasant and venerable face. For, as this part of the ceremony makes him giddy and sick, he shuts his eyes when it is performed. And having his eyes shut and a great mitre on his head, and his head itself wagging to and fro as they shook him in carrying, he looked as if his mask were going to tumble off. The two immense fans which are always borne, one on either side of him, accompanied him, of course, on this occasion. As they carried him along, he blessed the people with the mystic sign, and as he passed them, they kneeled down. When he had made the round of the church, he was brought back again, and if I am not mistaken, this performance was repeated, in the whole, three times. There was certainly nothing solemn or effective in it, and certainly very much that was droll and tawdry. But this remark applies to the whole ceremony, except the raising of the host, when every man in the guard dropped on one knee instantly, and dashed his naked sword on the ground, which had a fine effect. The next time I saw the cathedral, was some 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, when I climbed up into the ball, and then, the hangings being taken down, and the carpet taken up, but all the framework left, the remnants of these decorations looked like an exploded cracker. The Friday and Saturday having been solemn festa days, and Sunday being always a dies non in carnival proceedings, we had looked forward, with some impatience and curiosity, to the beginning of the new week. Monday and Tuesday being the two last and best days of the carnival. On the Monday afternoon at 1 or 2 o'clock, there began to be a great rattling of carriages into the courtyard of the hotel, a hurrying to and fro of all the servants in it, and, now and then, a swift shooting across some doorway or balcony of a straggling stranger in a fancy dress, not yet sufficiently well used to the same to wear it with confidence, and defy public opinion. All the carriages were open, and had the linings carefully covered with white cotton or calico, to prevent their proper decorations from being spoiled by the incessant pelting of sugar plums, and people were packing and cramming into every vehicle as it waited for its occupants, enormous sacks and baskets full of these confetti, together with such heaps of flowers, tied up in little nosegays, that some carriages were not only brimful of flowers, but literally running over, scattering, at every shake and jerk of the springs, some of their abundance on the ground. Not to be behindhand in these essential particulars, we caused 2 very respectable sacks of sugar plums, each about 3 feet high, and a large clothes basket full of flowers, to be conveyed into our hired barouche, with all speed, and from our place of observation, in one of the upper balconies of the hotel, we contemplated these arrangements with the liveliest satisfaction. The carriages now beginning to take up their company and move away, we got into ours, and drove off to, armed with little wire masks for our faces, the sugar plums, like Falstaff's adulterated sack, having lime in their composition. The Corso is a street a mile long, a street of shops, and palaces, and private houses, sometimes opening into a broad piazza. There are verandas and balconies, of all shapes and sizes, to almost every house, not on one story alone, but often to one room or another on every story, put there in general with so little order or regularity, that if, year after year, and season after season, it had rained balconies, hailed balconies, snowed balconies, blown balconies, they could scarcely have come into existence in a more disorderly manner. This is the great fountainhead and focus of the carnival. But all the streets in which the carnival is held, being vigilantly kept by dragoons, it is necessary for carriages, in the first instance, to pass, in line, down another thoroughfare, and so come into the Corso at the end remote from the Piazza del Popolo, which is one of its terminations. Accordingly, we fell into the string of coaches, and, for some time, jogged on quietly enough, now crawling on at a very slow walk, now trotting half a dozen yards, now backing 50, and now stopping altogether, as the pressure in front obliged us. If any impetuous carriage dashed out of the rank and clattered forward, with the wild idea of getting on faster, it was suddenly met, or overtaken, by a trooper on horseback, who, deaf as his own drawn sword to all remonstrances, immediately escorted it back to the very end of the row, and made it a dim speck in the remotest perspective. Occasionally, we interchanged a volley of confetti with the carriage next in front, or the carriage next behind, but as yet, this capturing of stray and errant coaches by the military was the chief amusement. Presently, we came into a narrow street, where, besides one line of carriages going, there was another line of carriages returning. Here the sugar plums and the nosegays began to fly about, pretty smartly, and I was fortunate enough to observe one gentleman attired as a Greek warrior, catch a light-whiskered brigand on the nose. He was in the very act of tossing up a bouquet to a young lady in a first-floor window, with a precision that was much applauded by the bystanders. As this victorious Greek was exchanging a facetious remark with a stout gentleman in a doorway one half black and one half white, as if he had been peeled up the middle who had offered him his congratulations on this achievement, he received an orange from a housetop, full on his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.